On the 16th of September 1918, the London Gazette published this citation for a military cross. It says, "For conspicuous gallantry and devotion to duty, he superintended the clearing of wounded under heavy fire from snipers and machine guns, when both stretcher-bearers carrying a wounded man became casualties. He remained with the man under heavy fire until fresh bearers arrived and carried him away." But those few words only tell a fraction of the story of the Reverend Arthur, known as Kellam Swallow, chaplain to the 2nd Battalion of the South Wales Borderers between 1916 and 1919. He was an incredibly brave man, who we're going to find out in this week's podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. He thought more of the lives of others, and even of the dead, than he did of his own safety, of his own self. The award of the Military Cross came during the Lees Offensive in April of 1918. But believe me, he'd achieved much more before that. And he went on to achieve a lot more afterwards during the Great War and then beyond. For the rest of his long life, he contributed so much to the country that he loved so much. For many months now, I've been thinking about recording a podcast about some of the chaplains, or padres, that served on the Western Front in the Great War. There are so many to choose from, but I've chosen the Chaplain Swallow this week, because he was the rector for a short time of the church where I got married in 1991, St Peter's Church in Weston Faville, Northampton. It means I have a connection to him. He was born in 1890, the son of a cleric who was once headmaster of St Kenham's Prep School in Durham. But in February of 1916, the local newspaper in Northampton tells us that the Reverend Arthur Kellam Swallow, curate of St Saviour's in Leicester, has been presented to the benefice of Weston Faville, vacant by the resignation of the Reverend Terry. The new director is the son of the Reverend William Swallow, who from 1895 until his death some years ago was the rector of Weston Faville. The Reverend Swallow will be one of the youngest incumbents in Northamptonshire, but both at university and at Leicester he has proved that he has a capacity for hard work and for organisation. But his stay here in Northampton was short-lived, because soon afterwards he joined the 2nd Battalion of the South Wales Borderers as a chaplain and made his way over to France on the 11th of November 1916, just after the battalion had suffered terrible casualties during the Battle of the Somme. And the first thing that Kellam was to experience on the battlefields was the aftermath of some of the fighting around Goudicourt on the Somme that the battalion had experienced in October of 1916, fighting in the mud and the slime as it began to rain on the Somme, making everything so much more difficult. We'll find out what he experienced there. And during this podcast, we're not just going to talk about what he achieved on the Western Front, because after the war, he went to Coventry, became an assistant priest at the cathedral, and he started to teach at the grammar school. And then he had an idea of forming a school himself. He founded the Coventry Prep School. We'll find out a little bit more about that later on. But I think I've got a fair idea of what motivated him to join up and serve with the forces, although not a combatant. And it was because his younger brother, Harvey, had been killed at Lewes in September of 1915. He was a junior officer serving with the Yorks and Lancaster Regiment. They were attacking Hill 70. He was wounded and sent back at some stage. As he made his way back, Harvey was killed by shellfire. His body was never found. When Kellam decided to enlist in the BEF, Harvey was still reported missing. And of course, they never did get that closure. Maybe it was the memory of his young brother that inspired him to carry out some of the incredible feats that we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. So let's start his journey. As soon as he arrived in France on the Somme in November of 1916, and to get an idea of where they were, I've looked at the battalion diary of the 2nd Battalion of the South Wales Borderers, and they were still really licking their wounds after the heavy fighting on the La Transloy ridges. The battalion diary tells us that on November the 15th they were at the Citadel camp, which was near Fricourt, and at 10 a.m. they moved up to Carnoy, which was a frontline position on the 1st of July but was now a few miles behind the lines, and there was another camp there. And then on the following day, on the 16th, they moved up once again to the support trenches behind Le Bouffes. They arrived early in the afternoon. Relief, it says, was completed in daylight, but the trenches on the following day were in a very bad condition. Shells had blown in many of the dugouts. It was very, very cold. 10 degrees of frost and a strong easterly wind was blowing. The mud had all been frozen stiff, which did make movement much easier. And the men were employed in improving the trenches. But then it got warmer, created a thaw. And on the 19th, we find that it's wet but milder. The trenches are now full of water and the mud has become extremely bad. They remained in those support positions, fighting the conditions rather than the enemy, for another 5 days. It wasn't until the 24th that they went back to Carnoy. And that's where we pick up the story from the chaplain Swallow. He wrote an article after the war, which we're going to refer to quite a bit, and this is what he said of his first experiences when he met up with the Borderers at Carnoy. In November 1916, I found myself in the indescribable mud of Carnoy camp on the Somme. It was my privilege and good luck to remain with that grand body of men whose spirit never flagged in face of the appalling sacrifice and suffering which a frontline division of the stormtroopers had to face time after time until April 1919, except for a certain amount of bloodshed owing to forcible impact on barbed wire entanglements in the dark. I never got a scratch. The men, what was left of them, about 250 instead of the normal strength of 900 or so, were resting in this morass of mud after the terrible Goudincourt episode, when, coming out of the line, many of them had slipped off the duckboards trapped by night like flies and perished in the water-filled shell holes. Soon, we were moved up into the line again. There came a night when rations had to be got up to the front line, and there was scarcely anybody to take them, so I lent a hand. I was much more anxious in those days to see what the front line was like than I should be now, when I am sure nothing short of dragging me up would ever persuade me to go near. The party consisted of a guide who did not know the way, a sergeant and about half a dozen of us, some carrying great containers of soup strapped to their backs, others sandbags with bully beef and biscuits. They gave me a stone jar of rum to carry. You'll observe that nothing damped their sense of humour, even then. I observed it too when, standing on the duckboard track in the evening twilight of that November day, all lined up waiting to start, I heard a Cockney Tommy of a company of Fusiliers just coming back on the parallel track, and he remarked, "Cor blimey, Bill, there's the effing parson with the effing rum." I heard a lot more of it somewhere about 4 a.m. when our guide, having got us completely lost, we met another party whose guide had got them more lost still, and the sergeants of each party exchanged opinions of guides and mud and the war in general. I never knew men could be so eloquent at such an hour. Then we pursued our way, sliding down shell holes and scrambling out again, but we got our goods delivered all right just before dawn. Now, as we've already seen, although he was a chaplain to the battalion, he was quite happy to offer his services to help with the effort, in this case taking up rations. As we'll see later, he did a lot more than that too. But in the next part of that article, he reverts to the day job being a chaplain and offering spiritual advice to the men. He talks about the hardships that he had to deal with when preparing sermons. He says there was no peace, no privacy anywhere, night or day, just perpetual noise and racket. I used to hold voluntary services in any old place I could get, and they were always well attended. I recall a wonderful Christmas Day service that we actually held in a stable and another one down in a cellar. Sometimes when the companies were out at rest but scattered, I would conduct as many as 10 or 12 in one day, riding on horseback with 50 hymn books strapped onto my horse. It was wearisome, but it was worthwhile, as long as the men felt that I knew by personal experience what they were up against, I found them willing enough to give me their ear. So after the Somme, the battalion finds themselves involved in the bloody Battle of Arras in April of 1917. And Swallows there, he says there was another ration-carrying episode which occurred in front of Arras at Easter 1917. A few of us were making for the headquarters mess, led by a very small, very rotund regimental sergeant major. Midway, gas shells poured down on us. We were all loaded up to the ears, and I personally was like a Christmas tree, carrying a petrol can full of water, two rifles and a heavily laden pack on my back. The RSM gave orders for gas helmets to be donned at once, took his own off to warn us not to fall down shell holes, and promptly went headlong into one himself. I laughed so much at the sight that I was nearly gassed. But he who laughs best, who laughs last. We eventually arrived at the HQ dugout, a very deep one recently captured from the enemy, at the top of which a direct hit had occurred a short time previously. This had had the effect of covering the whole deep stairway with slippery mud. Knowing nothing of this, I trod upon what I took to be the top step, which wasn't there, and promptly slid down the entire stairway, gas helmet, pack, rifles and petrol can included, like one descending a water chute, and landed right on top of the primus stove, where the cook was boiling the colonel's soup for dinner. What everyone said is perhaps best passed over in silence. That shows that not only was he a man of faith, he'd got a tremendous sense of humour as well. But what he found to be his main job and what he's most well known for are the burials. He describes this as the most heartbreaking part of my job. And he was involved in the burial of a man that had been awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross, Sergeant Major Skinner of the King's Own Scottish Borderers. They got his body down and six other VCs, all from the same 29th Division, bore him on a gun carriage to the grave in the cemetery at Valamatingi. One of the bearer of VCs was a private soldier, and another was a general. And then they leave the Arras area, and it's the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres, and it's the second stage of that battle at Langemark on the 16th of August 1917. He's there, and he does something absolutely remarkable on that day. He wrote a letter to his mother. Seeing men had been killed in no man's land, he gathers together some small wooden crosses to erect over their graves. And he leaves the safety of his own position and goes out into no man's land. This is what he says. He says, "We hadn't got far before the enemy spotted us. It was broad daylight and a rifle shot rang out unpleasantly near. I was carrying three big white crosses and immediately hoisted one high above my head and went straight on, literally under the shadow of the cross. We had no further trouble and we were able to put up the crosses and come back safely." One of those men whose graves he marked was a lieutenant in the South Wales Borderers, a David Charles Phillips, who'd come from Llanelli in South Wales. He was 22 years old, and was leading his men into battle when he was killed. And he's now buried in the Artillery Wood Cemetery, not far from where he died. Without Swallow's intervention, Phillips would be one of those missing and remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. But he isn't. He has a grave. All thanks to the chaplain Swallow who risked his life. Another man that Swallow buried was a private Ernest Manton. who came from his and my hometown of Northampton. The Northampton War Memorial is in a place called Abington Square. Just a few paces away is where Ernest, who was known as Lou, lived with his parents. He was just 19 when he died in November of 1917. Swallow wrote home to the parents to give them some kind of consolation. He said, "I knew your boy intimately all the time he was with us. He's one of those who I can never forget, cheery and smiling under all circumstances, straight and upright in character, and a splendid young soldier, worthy of the town he came from and the home he died to defend. His smile was like a ray of sunshine on a dull day." It was a dull day that he died in November of that year, and he's now in one of those large concentration cemeteries at Cement House, not far from Langemark. And then we get to April of 1918, the Lees Offensive. This is the day, the 11th of April, the day after the beginning of the battle, that Swallow was to carry out the action that saw him awarded the Military Cross. To find out what happened that day, let's have a look at the battalion diary. It says that the enemy attacked and worked through the exposed flank of the battalion. The battalion headquarters was taken, and Major Somerville was last seen with one platoon defending a small portion of trench. But the enemy were close and rounded the flank. The other flank held on until the enemy rushed the trench from behind, and after this, the remainder of the front line fell back. Casualties were very heavy, and the men became disorganised. Small parties fighting with different units during the remainder of the day. At dusk, various parties of the battalion were collected at brigade headquarters and reformed under Captain Davis. The total numbers were now only 140 and three officers left. None of the officers who went in with the battalion got back, except three who were wounded early, and the whole of battalion headquarters were either killed or captured on the 11th. And then there's a table that shows us the total casualties. 17 of the 21 officers that were casualties were missing. Other ranks, 18 killed, 146 wounded, 12 wounded and missing. But missing, most of them we now know were captured, 335. Meaning total casualties for the battalion, 511. As it says, there was just a handful that were left. Swallow would have seen all this happening. And as we already know, he wasn't the sort of man who was just going to stand back and do nothing. We've heard at the beginning of the podcast the original citation that was published in the London Gazette. There was more information provided to us in the local newspaper. It says, "The gallantry of the Reverend Swallow, Rector of Weston Faithful and Chaplain to the 2nd South Wales Borders, has gained for him the well-earned distinction of the Military Cross. He has been further honoured by the immortal 29th Division with a parchment stating that his bravery and devotion to duty are inscribed in the records of the division and with a decoration of laurel leaves to be worn on his right arm. The particular deeds for which he has been awarded these honours were undertaken on the night of April the 11th, when he went out five times under shellfire to fetch in wounded and was the only officer of his battalion who escaped unhurt during the recent offensive. This, however, is by no means the first time that he's been out to rescue wounded under fire or to bury the dead in no man's land." And then there's another letter to his mum from Swallow, giving her some idea of what the conditions were like at this stage in 1918 on the Western Front. This is what he says. "I sleep in a place and consider myself extremely fortunate to get it, with a Tommy underneath me and another on top, so confined that our bodies are on the wire netting are touching. And if I move or turn, both the others get squashed. And if either of them move, I get depressed or elevated, as the case may be. You have to perform weird contortions, wriggling in or out, but once in and settled, it's quite comfy. Opposite is a large spring mattress dating from the Boche and from the civilian home which once stood here. And on this, four men, sometimes six, are either sleeping or eating night and day. The remainder arrange themselves on the floor or sleep sitting up on petrol tins. The cooking for the lot is done up under another corner on a primer stove, and as the capacities of the stove are strictly limited, it is on the go more or less continuously from 6 a.m. till midnight. Everybody gropes around like rabbits in a warren, with gutting candles and water splashing, and odd men and miners asleep on passage floors and on shelves and up corners, with some cooking breakfast, others tea. What a life! The only things I miss are rats and lice. There don't seem to be any here. Probably it bores them too. Everything is greasy and sticky. This morning my servant collected the drippings through the roof and washed my neck. There was some greasy salt in a greasy box which contained cigarettes in some distant area of the past. Many bottles, empty, three mugs doing duty for six people and containing at intervals rum, tea, lemon squash or whiskey. Greasy gas bags, greasy tin hats, leather jerkins, sandbags full of filth all around the walls. Without this wonderful apartment is a labyrinth of passages, all underground, all greasy, all wet. An electric torch is essential to the progress of any who would avoid stepping on slumbering men. They slumber on the stairways, up corners, in passages, on shelves, and those who are not slumbering are cooking weird concoctions by the aid of that mysterious implement known as the Tommy's cooker. As night and day are precisely the same, one can order one's doings with delightful freedom. And now it's October 1918. It's the final 100 days offensive. And yet still he's writing home, telling relatives of what happened to their boys, casualties of the Great War. He wrote to a Mrs. Webster from St. Helens, Merseyside, on the 18th of October 1918. He said, "It's with deep sorrow that I have to inform you of the death of your son in action this morning. We were advancing at the time and it was quite impossible to bring the bodies away, and I and a few more buried them during a lull in the fighting. We also made a rough cross and erected it over his grave, and if possible a more permanent one will be put up. Again assuring you of my heartfelt sympathy and trusting that God will comfort and bless you, I remain yours with sympathy." And because of Swallow's efforts, to this day, Webster does have a permanent headstone. He's buried near Ypres in a cemetery called the Zandvoort British Cemetery. He lies there in amongst 1,583 servicemen of the First World War. And a few weeks later comes what he calls the liberation of Belgium. He writes a letter to the local newspaper back home, and he calls it the martyrdom of Belgium. He says, "It's been my good fortune to be present at a scene which is hardly paralleled in history, for which England and the world have been waiting for 4 years, the liberation of Belgium. It is not yet complete, but it is well begun. For 4 years, the khaki of England and the field grey of Germany have wrestled for the mastery of that belt of unspeakable desolation and ruin which once was pleasant farmland and grove on the southern border of Belgium. A few mornings ago, the German line broke. For weeks we have gazed from afar at the spires and green fields stretching out into the promised land. Our boys, backed by our guns and shells, made by the women of England, pushed right through. It was not long before the streams of civilians began to pass through our lines, and our lines passed through them. Men, women and children of every age and condition. What this means to them can best be described in the words of one villager that we entered. He says, 'You have delivered us from 4 years of slavery. Everywhere we go, we hear the same testimony that the Germans have been nothing but a brute. For 4 years, these people tell us, they've been waiting and praying for us to come and deliver them. The arrival of our troops, although heralded by a fierce bombardment, was greeted by an enthusiasm which is impossible to describe. No son was ever greeted by his mother with greater joy than these poor mothers and wives of Belgium greeted the sons of England, the saviours of their name and their homes. One house which was entered by a man was found to contain not German troops, but an entire Belgian family grouped in prayer before the crucifix. They had assembled there when our bombardment opened, so they told us, so that they might pray together for the English to reach them. They could not do enough for us. The shells, the war, everything was forgotten in the joy of their deliverance. The stories they tell us of their treatment by the Germans are so horrible that it is not for such unanimous testimony it would be difficult to believe them. They speak of them of the great barbarians, and certainly the title is well deserved. In their hurried retreat, the enemy took everything, farm stock, cash, food, everything he wanted and could lay his hands on, and worse things that he did, and of which I cannot write. Perhaps they are best forgotten and left on the records of the supreme judge of mankind. Many of these civilians have unfortunately but inevitably been wounded and killed. In one period they are in the thick of the battle. Their fortitude is amazing. One poor woman was brought to us on a stretcher, wounded in the head. I shall never forget the expression of her eyes and her gratitude as we tried to ease her pain. I saw a party of our stretcher bearers led by a girl of 19 or 20, not back, but right forward into a village which at that time was anything but safe. What they have been through, God only knows. Yet they never complain. There are no tears or whining, just the joy of freedom at last. And most of them have nothing else but that, I'm afraid. They are living now with us, sharing Thomas' famous bully beef and our inexhaustible fund of good humour. 10 or 20 Tommies, 3 or 4 Belgian families, all squashed into one small cottage and all mucking in. That is a common sight. But they don't mind that, for they have not forgotten how Granny, aged 90, and they had to sleep on the floor in order that her commandant and his staff might occupy their beds, or how they lived on husks while the German grew fat on the fruits of their toil. No, they've not forgotten. And I don't suppose they ever will. And as I'm reading that, obviously Granny wouldn't have been around 22 years later, but the other inhabitants of that small part of Belgium would have been, when once again the Germans returned and occupied Belgium, this time with a much more ruthless rule for another 4 terrible years. I went down to Kew and got his service record out. There wasn't much in there. But when he was demobilised in 1919, his commanding officer wrote this about him. A steady, conscientious worker of the best type. One of the best all-round chaplains one could hope to have. To be honest, I think that's a bit of an understatement, don't you? But just going back to his own words again, he's described how cruel, perhaps, the Germans were to the people of Belgium, but that wasn't his own experience. This is what he said about the Germans. He said, I had an experience which showed me that the Germans were not quite such devils as we were all taught to believe in those mad days. A conviction more than confirmed in all that I saw of those people during the time I was with the Army of Occupation and in several visits to Germany since the war. The vast majority of them are as decent and gentle as the average Englishman. So I found in the Ypres salient at early dawn. We'd come out to rest. I'd got the carpenter to make a number of rough wooden crosses, which I was anxious to place by such bodies as I'd been able to identify, each inscribed with a fallen soldier's name. I had to have enough light to erect them, but not enough to be seen, for the track lay on top of a long ridge, with the Germans entrenched on each side. We timed our departure during the night so as to arrive at the desired spots just a little before dawn, but it was too light, we were seen. A rifle shot rang out, and another. I actually felt the swish of a bullet just in front of my nose. There was no cover of any description. Retreat and advance were alike useless. In despair, I took out one of my wooden crosses. I held it high above my head, hoping that I would see I was not engaged on an errand of mercy. Not another shot was fired. I wonder whether he was talking about that situation. Officer David Phillips at Langemark, I think the description is pretty much the same. He said, we went on and completed our job in broad daylight and in full view of the enemy only a few yards away. Whenever I hear of the saving power of the cross, I always think of that incident. My other story of German humanity relates to the time when we just captured the ground in front of Arras. At Foss Farm on the main Arras to Cambrai Road, I found a little German graveyard. There are about 6 German graves with neat stones, and in the middle of them one different from the rest. The cross of this one was of wood, and it was constructed from the propeller of an aeroplane. The wings, the badge of an English pilot, had been severed from his coat, and beneath, carefully painted in German, it read, "Here rests the English airman, N. de Pomeroy," with the date of his death, R.I.P. The photographs subsequently taken of this grave and the information I was able to send to his mother proved of comfort to her after long months of complete ignorance of her boy's fate. Now, I've been able to discover who that young man was. He was a pilot, Second Lieutenant Norman de Pomeroy, with the 11th Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps. He was shot down on the 20th of October 1916, died at the age of 25, and he came from Ashford in Kent. And in 1920, his body was discovered by the Imperial War Graves Commission. He was identified by his Flying Corps uniform and also his dentures. Now, his father had died before him, but his mother and sister were present at the exhumation of his body, and later that day he was buried in what's now the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, Cagnicourt British Cemetery. I remember one night in particular when those of us who were in the HQ mess were favoured with the best billet available. It was a pigsty and we were jolly glad to have it. It was about 3 foot high and we had to bend low in order to get in via the pig's entrance. The pigs had long since fled. That was some comfort. Well, the 5 of us all slept there, with one large stray dog sprawled across our legs the whole night, all nicely tucked up together and lovely and warm. And when the colonel said, "Turn," of course we did. We all had breakfast in bed in a row, and we were all in exceedingly bad tempers. At least I was, at any rate. It is interesting to reflect that all 4 of my companions that night in the pigsty still survive. One is a sergeant major, another is a high officer at the Ministry of Health, another a famous specialist in the north of England, and the 4th the headmaster of a public school. And yet, if one of us now finds his top sheet a little too short, I suppose the whole household hears about it. Mine does anyhow, and I expect the others are just as unreasonable. So you would think, after being demobbed, that Swallow would return to Northampton and take up his position once again at the church here in Weston Favell. But no, not him. He decides to go off and do something much more challenging. He decided that he wanted to create a school where children would be happy and inspired. This would be a suitable memorial, he thought, to the loss of his brother. And in 1920, he purchased a property in Coventry, known as The Firs. Coventry is a city in the West Midlands. Coventry Prep School was born. He, of course, became the headmaster of the school, and he continued teaching there until well into his 80s. He kept in close contact with the school even after his retirement. He visited it most days. He tended his small garden that he had there, and he was often seen chatting and having lunch at the school. And for many years, the school was actually known as the Swallows. In January of 1979, it snowed in the UK, and the snow, it never does now. It stayed around for weeks, months, I think. And Swallow, then aged 88, went out and slipped over and sadly died after his head struck the road curb. He never did marry. He was a bachelor. But a Miss Helen Brown, she was his housekeeper for 15 years, and after he died, she said he was very active, not only going out regularly for walks, but riding his bicycle to the wonder of people who saw him. He was fond of gardening and last summer played croquet. Swallow was cremated at a crematorium in Coventry. But he had one last act after the war to carry out. As I mentioned, he was only the rector at Weston Favell Church for a few months before going out to the Western Front. But he returned to the church one last time in October of 1921, when the church memorial was unveiled to remember the 16 lads of the village that had perished in the Great War. He gave a sermon. This is what he said. He said, "The men who came back required no eloquence or tribute. They rarely talked about their experiences because they knew that most people in England did not understand." Arthur Kenelm Swallow, Military Cross, never ever fired a rifle. He never ever loaded a shell into an artillery gun. He didn't command an army, but he performed a vital role, several vital roles, on the Western Front between 1916 and 1919. He went out there, no doubt, like they all did, these chaplains, to offer spiritual guidance to the men that were putting their lives at risk to defend their country. But when he got there, he found that he could be much more useful to the men and to the war effort. Of course, he was still there to offer that guidance, but he provided humour and practical assistance. And how on earth he wasn't shot when he crawled out into no man's land time and time again to recover the wounded, marked the spot that these boys died so they could be properly remembered. How on earth, how did he survive that? He says that he was sheltered by one of those wooden crosses he was carrying. I wonder whether it was more than that. I think about him most days when I pass the memorial in our village. I think about his brother, of course, who has no known grave and is remembered on the Lewes Memorial. But of course, as Swallow said, I've no idea what they went through. He lived a long and fulfilling life. He was a man of strong religious conviction, of course he was. So I think that this week we should end the podcast with a hymn. "I vow to thee, my country," is often sang at the Festival of Remembrance at the Royal Albert Hall. And this particular version of it is sung by a man called Luke Evans. Thank you for tuning in as we remember not just the chaplain Swallow, but all of those men that he managed to save and those that he didn't save, but he marked their graves so they could be remembered in perpetuity.
I vow to thee, my country, all earthly things above, entire and whole and perfect, the service of thy love, the love that asks no questions, the love that stands the test, that lays upon the altar the dearest and the best, the love that never falters, the love that pays the price, the love that makes undaunted the final sacrifice, the love that has no questions, the love that stands the